Is he really just a personification of the dark side of the Force itself? Maybe the Emperor never turned to the dark side, but rather is inherently evil. The Emperor would then be evil incarnate. He isn't only evil himself, but provides the ultimate explanation for why there are other, less powerful, evil persons in that galaxy far, far away. This would be evil in true Manichaean fashion. On the other hand, if the Emperor was himself once turned by another, imagine that he too was once some venerable Sith Lord's apprentice. We might want to know who turned the Emperor's master. Surely not every evil person could have been turned by another. There must be an end to the chain of evil persons that culminates in at least one first seducer, some servant of the dark side, who either is evil by his very nature, as the Manichees think of the evil god, or else was once good but turned himself to evil. Augustine rejects the Manichaean explanation of evil because he believes that the supremely good God creates all beings in the universe, and so no creature is inherently evil. Instead, since rational creatures, such as the Emperor, Darth Maul, and Darth Vader have free will, each one of them is ultimately responsible for their own turn to the dark side. Obi-Wan hints at this when he says,
"Vader was seduced by the dark side of the Force."
For we typically think that every seduction requires two willing participants, the seducer and the one seduced. Let's assume that Anakin Skywalker is responsible in this way for his turn to the dark side. Factors external to Anakin may still have an influence on his choice. The Emperor's temptations, Anakin's desires for Padme, his mother's death at the hands of the Sand People, and his conflicted relationship with Obi-Wan certainly all go some distance towards making sense of his fall. But Anakin does not have to turn to the dark side as a result of these events. Anakin made choices in all of these contexts that he knew were evil. He didn't have to make such choices. As Anakin confesses to Padme after slaughtering a tribe of Sand People, "I'm a Jedi. I know I'm better than this." But why do otherwise good people do bad things in the first place? Augustine is particularly perplexed by this question. If God is the perfectly good and all-powerful creator of the universe, how could one of God's good creatures turn to evil? According to Christian tradition, the original sin is pride, wanting to find oneself in a place of honor higher than one deserves. Indeed, pride appears to be Anakin's original sin, too. He thinks he doesn't need Obi-Wan as a master, when it's obvious that Obi-Wan has much to teach the young Padawan. Anakin chooses to begin thinking of himself as better than Obi-Wan, even though in some way he knows he isn't. In a moment of unguarded anger, Anakin says to Padme, "It's all Obi-Wan's fault. He's jealous. He's holding me back." The question of the origin of evil is no problem for the Manichees, since for them, evil has always existed in the form of the evil god. But this Manichaean view, as Augustine began to see as a young man, has the problematic consequence that people aren't really responsible for their actions. Why does Anakin turn to the dark side? The Manichaean answer? The Emperor made him do it. But Augustine wants to maintain that we're free and morally responsible for our actions. Anakin is ultimately responsible for his turn to the dark side. The origin of moral evil in Anakin is Anakin himself and his own pride. Much the same could be said of the Emperor, Darth Maul, and Jabba the Hutt. A creature that freely wills to do evil is the first cause of moral evil in that creature. Therefore, there are as many causes of moral evil in the universe as there are persons who have freely willed to do evil. The fate of evil after the overthrow of the Empire. Does the following plotline for a Hollywood movie sound familiar? Hero emerges. Hero shows promise in battling evil, but suffers some temporary setback because of a lack of knowledge and experience. Finally, hero blossoms in a way that surpasses all hopes, and everyone, except the villain, of course, lives happily ever after. And, at least for a while, we as moviegoers are lost in the possibility that we too might one day live happily ever after. That evil can be roundly defeated is an assumption driving almost every Hollywood movie, not to mention some great works of literature. The Star Wars saga has its Hollywood ending too, We're left with the distinct impression at the end of Return of the Jedi that the dark side has been vanquished by the Jedi once and for all. Not only is the Emperor overthrown, but Luke has refused to do what his father and so many others had done before him, give in to the temptation to use the Force to serve the darker side of our nature. He's done what others could or would not do. The film ends with nothing less than Anakin Skywalker's own redemption, largely inspired by Luke's filial love and devotion. Although 3 of the 6 Star Wars films end with a victory celebration, there's something different about the party on Endor. After all, consider who shows up. Obi-Wan, Yoda, and Anakin, complete in their otherworldly luminescent attire. Without explicitly saying so, Return of the Jedi leaves the viewer with the distinct impression that everyone lived happily ever after. Perhaps films that intend to entertain must have their Hollywood endings. An epic like Star Wars would seem incomplete without it. But maybe there is some deeper significance in the universal human desire, codified in the stories we choose to tell ourselves, that everything will turn out all right in the end. Although the young and selfish Han Solo can't quite believe it, perhaps there is some all-powerful force controlling everything. Will we always be at the mercy of evil and its effects? If evil is a necessary part of reality, the flip side of goodness, so to speak, then the answer to this question must be yes. Evil will always be with us, at least as a very real possibility. The Emperor may be dead and all may seem well, but somewhere out there, another Emperor-like figure is already scheming and angling for power. And there will always be plenty of Anakin Skywalkers in the world, persons of great talent and potential who could, at any moment, fall from grace and give in to the dark side's temptation to believe that power is more important than moral purity. If evil has the nature envisioned by Plato and the Manichees, then the most we can reasonably hope for are longer periods of time when the dark side lies dormant. Imagine that the fall of good and the rise of evil is something inevitable, that evil is really a necessary feature of the universe. If this is the case, one might well wonder, what's the point of fighting evil at all if it can't be completely defeated? Can we really be expected to fight evil without any hope of victory in the end? What's so good, for me, about being good? Providing satisfactory answers to these questions is at least one reason philosophers such as Augustine think it's important to defend the notion that God exists and is omnipotent. Human beings have a need to believe that everything will turn out all right in the end. Augustine's defense of the existence of a perfectly good and all-powerful creator is one important and influential philosophical attempt to show that the human desire for closure in the saga that is our universe is a well-founded one. Chapter 7. Be mindful of the living force. Environmental ethics in Star Wars. Elizabeth F. Cook. A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, good and evil looked remarkably similar to the good and evil we see in our world today. Of course, most of the species, planetary systems, and technological gadgets are foreign to us living in the 21st century. But the basic values of democracy, equality, and justice are the same. And the epic hero, the Jedi Knight, shares the same characteristics of the warrior hero in Western culture since the Homeric age. He's a brave and skilled fighter, devoted to a just cause, and above all, a master over his mind and body. These common values at play in Star Wars allow the story to speak to us, despite such an unfamiliar backdrop. But something else comes to light when the backdrop involves intergalactic travel, the power of the Force, Death Stars, the Dagobah system, Wookiees, Ewoks, and Gungans. We find that the Star Wars galaxy reveals a rich approach to environmental ethics, one quite relevant for issues in our own world. Environmental ethics is a branch of philosophy which uses ethical theories to solve very practical matters concerning animals, plants, and the environment as a whole. Now, the environmental ethic at work in Star Wars is probably not readily apparent. After all, the Rebel Alliance concerns itself with only the humanistic values of democracy and freedom, and the Jedi Knights, guardians of peace and justice, exemplars of all that is good, don't seem all that concerned for animals or the environment. What set of values, then, can account for restoring balance to the force, which somehow includes all the different creatures, cultures, and planets? This issue requires our attention to the fact that the force is indeed a living force. And here, as Yoda would say,
the answer to our question,
we will find.
Wookiees and Minox and Hutts, oh my! Environmental ethics is concerned with the proper relationship between humans and their environment. Generally, it asks what our responsibilities are beyond the human community and whether we owe ethical treatment to non-human animals, plants, and ecosystems. A central issue, then, is what kind of value animals, plants, and ecosystems have. Intrinsic value, as goods in themselves, or mere instrumental value, insofar as they're useful for something else. Some environmental ethicists argue that the environment has instrumental value only. While humans may have intrinsic value, we give value to other non-human things by virtue of our valuing them. So everything from cell phones to lightsabers to the Mona Lisa has value only because humans deem it to. These environmental ethicists urge us to see that the environment offers us tremendous goods, food, oxygen, aesthetic enjoyment, and more, which are instrumental in pursuing our goals, but not in infinite supply. Thus, to protect our long-term interests and those of future generations, we should work to preserve the environment. Other philosophers argue that this resource management approach misses the point of an environmental ethic. It's criticized for being yet another anthropocentric ethic, which unjustly places humans at the center of what is to be valued. One such critic is the contemporary philosopher Peter Singer, who agrees with the view that value depends on a conscious being, a valuer, who gives value to things, but disagrees that humans are the only beings who count as conscious valuers. For Singer, ethics is concerned with protecting the interests of others, which essentially requires working to increase others' pleasure and alleviate their suffering. And he holds that consciousness, or the capacity for subjective experience, is both necessary and a sufficient condition for having an interest. This means, then, to have an interest, one must be capable of feeling, being consciously aware of, pleasure and pain. But of course, many non-human animals have this ability. Animals, too, are conscious valuers and have interests. At the very least, the interest to seek pleasure and avoid pain. Humans thus owe animals decent and humane treatment, just as we do other humans. Singer argues that we have no good reason to extend ethical treatment solely to humans, a bias he calls speciesism. Speciesism parallels the injustice of racism by arbitrarily giving special status to the interests of individual humans over and above the interests of other animals, just because they're members of our same species. Singer's point is that consciousness is what's morally relevant, not membership in a certain species. And while there may not be an absolutely clear line of demarcation between animals which have consciousness and animals which don't, according to Singer, all mammals and birds should clearly be included because they can feel pain. But then what are we to think of Luke Skywalker, who shoots womp rats in his T-16 and even brags about it to his friend Wedge? Presumably, womp rats can feel pain. Yet, this is no concern to our otherwise young moral hero. The question of the ethical treatment of animals in Star Wars proves difficult, since the distinction between human and animals simply doesn't hold, or at least not in the same way. After all, Yoda clearly isn't human, but we couldn't call him a mere animal either. And other non-human creatures like Watto, the Toydarian junk dealer, and Jabba the Hutt raise similar problems. At the same time, some creatures certainly behave like animals, for example, Minox and Wampas. So perhaps our question should be rephrased. Are animal-like creatures treated ethically by the human-like creatures? We do see some humane relationships between human-like and animal-like creatures. Han Solo and Chewbacca have a kind of friendship, albeit not one of equals, a point parodied in the film Spaceballs. Chewie is like a pet dog, loyal, dependable, and even well-trained, but not completely so. Apparently, Wookiees just aren't good losers, or so Han warns C-3PO when R2-D2 plots to defeat Chewie at a board game. But overall, Chewbacca is treated almost like one of us. And on the other side, ethical corruption in Star Wars is often illustrated through the inhumane treatment of animals by characters such as Jabba the Hutt and Count Dooku. Creatures like the Reek, the Nexu, and the Acklay are unleashed on Obi-Wan, Padme, and Anakin in the Geonosian arena as a spectator sport, like the lions of the ancient Roman Colosseum. And Jabba casts a slave dancer down to the dungeon pit to be eaten by the wild rancor. In addition to the potential harm done to the human-like creatures, there's the questionable presence of exotic animals, far from their natural habitats, in circus-like roles serving humans, or the human-like, for entertainment as well as other purposes. These animals are owned, and their natural functions, like eating meat, are put on display. As we'll see, this is completely out of sync with the Jedi way. Although there's no mention of rights for animal-like creatures by the good guys in Star Wars, they can't be guilty of simple speciesism. Surely something like interspecies rights is at work in the Galactic Senate. Members of different species work together, cooperatively, for the most part, toward the same political and ethical goals. Their different appearances are so irrelevant for the purposes of democratic participation that different species intermingle as if they're merely different cultures or ethnic groups. We see interspecies cooperation in the Jedi Order and the Rebel Alliance as well. What brings these creatures together is capability rather than species. In particular, self-consciousness is important here. The abilities to self-reflect and rationally deliberate are the very conditions for participation in democracy, which has as its center equality, rights, and justice based on the intrinsic value of every human being or human-like creature. Here we see the very strong humanistic element in Star Wars, with a reminder that human need not apply only to Luke, Han, and the like. But many environmental ethicists would argue that the interspecies relations we see in Star Wars fall short of an animal ethic, since equal treatment and respect extends only to those creatures who are human-like, while there's no mention for ethical treatment for the animal-like creatures. Star Wars seems to employ an anthropocentric ethic, in that only human-like traits are valued, and only because they're human-like. In the end, critics argue that an ethic which excludes non-human animals allows for their use or destruction in the name of human interests. Value in nature. Beyond animal ethics, the philosopher Holmes Rolston III argues for the intrinsic value of both animal and non-animal life. If something is said to have intrinsic value, it usually implies that it should be respected and not used or destroyed. For example, the intrinsic value of each human being means that we owe respect to every individual and are not permitted under any circumstance to practice slavery or use humans as test subjects without their knowledge and consent. In the same sense, Rolston argues that we're obligated to respect nature due to its intrinsic value, rather than its instrumental value for humans. Humans don't put value in the environment. It's already there. All of nature is a productive and creative process, and there is value wherever there is positive creativity. Rolston reminds us that when we're walking in the woods, far from other humans, something tells us that although no other human may walk this path again to see the beautiful flowers, we still ought not to pick them. Each flower struggles to survive, to defend its life, and we should not interrupt this process needlessly. The organism seeks its own good, or telos, the natural goal of an organism, which requires different actions depending on its species. A plant photosynthesizes, while a wampa seeks and eats meat. And this process is itself intrinsically creative. If a plant's stem is cut off, it will repair itself. It will work to recover in a way that a blaster or an AT-AT walker won't. Although plants and some animals are not conscious of this process, it's the creative process, not the awareness of it, that has value. By itself, this view would appear to be an environmental individualism, the view that we have ethical obligations to distinct individuals, in this case, each living organism, and not necessarily to species or the environment as a whole. But Rolston argues that ultimately each individual organism shouldn't be seen apart from its relationships with other organisms or from those processes which produced it. In other words, their ecosystem. The sea monsters in the waters of Naboo, for example, must be seen as part of their larger ecosystem, including the water, the caves, and the other organisms in the food chain to which they've had to adapt. An ecosystem isn't simply a collection of interacting individuals, but a system of processes and relationships between different organisms. This system creates and sustains life. Natural processes don't just create organisms. They create diversity within species. And this ends up being good for the overall ecosystem. In this sense, ecosystems seek their own good, and for this reason, the ecosystem should be valued as well. So while intrinsic value is typically considered independent of all else, Ralston insists that it be considered within a whole system. In other words, each organism has intrinsic value, but intrinsic value is an absolute value, as is normally believed. He says, "The dialectic of instrumental and intrinsic values, embedded in systemic value, is communitarian without subtracting anything organismic, because it integrates organic parts in a community whole. Earthworms are of value because they aerate the soil for grasses and supply food for catbirds, but also because they have an inherent good of their own. Neither their instrumental value to grasses and catbirds, or to the system, nor their intrinsic value in themselves, no single thing alone, but the fusion of all, contributes to integrity, stability, and beauty in the community." This position, called environmental holism, maintains that the good of the whole biotic community requires recognizing the interdependence of organisms, and that the individual health and integrity of each organism depends on the health and integrity of the entire natural world. So, while the intrinsic value of living individuals militates against their arbitrary destruction or use, the fact that intrinsic value doesn't imply absolute value means that sometimes our ethical obligations to organisms may be trumped by other obligations. Choices can be made as to the importance of competing values. For Ralston, there is a hierarchy of value in nature, such that some values can be overridden by others. Respecting nature because it has value doesn't mean respecting equality among all living things. A self-conscious animal, say a Wookiee, can be said to have more value than a less conscious animal like a Minock. And yet, a Minock, insofar as it has an ability to feel pleasure and pain, will have more value than a non-conscious rock. But while there's hierarchy of value in Ralston's philosophy such that more sophisticated organisms have more value, this doesn't always mean humans first. As he says, humans count enough to have the right to flourish here on Earth, but not so much that we have the right to degrade or shut down ecosystems, not at least without a burden of proof that there is an overriding cultural gain. But although human interests will lose sometimes, when it comes to deforestation, for example, what we lose is also a good thing to lose, namely the exploitative attitude toward nature. And what we stand to gain is a more harmonious relationship with nature. Our obligation is to become responsible members of a human and biotic community. Ralston holds that many things need to be taken into account when making moral choices between individual animal, environmental, and human interests. For example, in our efforts to preserve the environment while pursuing human interests, special priority should be given to rare species, to species which play particular vital roles in ecosystems, to biodiversity in the ecosystem, and to the process, rather than just the products of nature. Now, when it comes to the Star Wars galaxy, environmental concerns aren't exactly the first priority. Yet there is evidence of a respect for nature and life evident in the Jedi worldview. May the Force be with you. Lessons from the Jedi. On the face of it, the Jedi way has much in common with a kind of mind-body dualism, whereby one must overcome his biological nature rather than become unified with it. After all, Yoda affirms to Luke that, "Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter." Yoda further insists that we not judge him by his physical size, and proves why in Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith. After death, a Jedi's body may disappear, And indeed, Obi-Wan Kenobi becomes even more powerful after he dies and loses his physical being. This seems to suggest that the Jedi are more like minds who temporarily learn to work within their bodies, as one might learn to move around in a car. At the very least, this means that consciousness, the mental life of the Jedi, is more than just biological matter. But this isn't the whole picture. After all, life creates the Force. It's an energy field created by all living things, Obi-Wan tells Luke. The point is echoed by Yoda.
For my ally is the Force, and a powerful ally it is. Life creates it, makes it grow. Its energy surrounds us and binds us. You must feel the Force around you. Here, between you, me, the tree, the rock, everywhere.
This isn't so much the mind over matter picture as one of mind and matter interacting as two parts of a whole. A Jedi Padawan's task is to become more in touch with the physical world by being more at one with the Force, a task achieved through both physical and mental training. A Jedi must learn to feel the Force, rather than just think about it. This allows him to move physical objects without touching them, influence other minds, and see without looking. There's an important biological basis here. The Force speaks through living creatures, and only to other living creatures. This may be explained by what Qui-Gon Jinn says to young Anakin Skywalker that
midichlorians are a microscopic life form residing in all living cells. We have a symbiotic relationship with them, living together for mutual advantage.
As Qui-Gon puts it, without the midichlorians, life could not exist. They continually speak to us, telling us the will of the Force. This implies that we already exist in a symbiotic relationship with these messengers of the Force, and when a young Padawan learns to quiet the mind, he can learn the will of the Force by feeling it through the midichlorians in his cells. Control of one's mind, then, is also control of, and a kind of listening to, one's body, so that mind and body can be one. So when a Jedi says, "May the Force be with you," he really means, "May you be with the Force, and may you quiet your mind to listen to it, to be aware of it." Learning to listen to the Force also connects the Jedi with other living things, creating a kind of harmony with them. And in this sense, Jedi training is training in respecting nature. After all, it is a respect for the living Force. The Jedi learns to recognize symbiotic relationships of the natural world. Once he learns this, he grows in wisdom by understanding the entire natural world and his proper place within it.
Mudhole, slimy, my home this is.
Jedi living in the natural world. The natural world confers powers of wisdom and balance, and its natural environments in which Jedi feel most at home. During the dark times of the Empire, the surviving Jedi retreat from the city planet Coruscant to hide among the natural caves of the Tatooine Desert or the swampy marshes of Dagobah. They live with nature, rather than against it, in sparse, simple dwellings. And when a Jedi gets into trouble, he consistently finds an ally in the natives of some very natural environments. The eco-communities of the Gungans and the Ewoks are very much at one with their environments. The Gungans are less technologically advanced than most other nearby cultures, while the Ewoks have virtually no technology. Ewoks live within the trees, and their homes, clothes, and weapons are made out of simple materials directly from their environment. Right away, Leia and Wicket the Ewok are natural allies against the stormtroopers. There seems to be no general evil found on Endor. Never mind that the Ewoks originally captured and planned to eat Han, Luke, and Chewie. It was nothing personal. In Star Wars, there's a big ethical difference between violence done out of duty or necessity, the Jedi and the Ewoks respectively, and violence done out of anger or greed, Anakin slaughtering the Sand People in revenge, and the Bounty Hunters respectively. Strangely enough, the Jedi are fighting to establish what these natural communities already have, a unity and harmony with the world. For if we asked ourselves what the galaxy would look like after balance is restored to the Force, We might guess that it's a galaxy where democracy reigns, but an intergalactic democracy that lets eco-communities like the Ewoks and the Gungans live harmoniously and maintain their distinct identities as peoples. In other words, it would be a galaxy where harmony and diversity are supreme, which are the very ideals of environmental ethics. Only biological creatures are in touch with the Force in this way. Here we learn of a key distinction between artifacts and organisms in Star Wars. And Ralston makes this same point, first made by Aristotle. A machine doesn't have its own natural goal, but instead receives its purpose from humans. A machine has no self-generating or self-defending tendencies. In our world as of yet, only biological creatures have this. Robots can't reprogram themselves the way that even earthworms or algae can in order to adapt creatively to a change in the environment. And time and again, we see that for all the threat and intimidation of the technologically advanced stormtroopers, battle droids, AT-AT walkers, and the Death Star, ultimately, they can't outdo biological creatures working in harmony. When battle droids collide with Gungans and stormtroopers with the Ewoks, the biological creatures always have the surprising advantage. They work with nature to defend nature, and nature is one with the Force. By doing this, they can respond to new and challenging environments. Jedi know this, and while they use technology, it's always in the service of the Force of nature. So while the dark side moves closer and closer to overcoming the natural world, it fails in the end. When push comes to shove, the natural processes in the biological world can always overcome human creations of technology, even if it's the ultimate power in the universe, the Death Star. As Darth Vader admonishes one Imperial officer, "Don't be too proud of this technological terror you've constructed. The ability to destroy a planet is insignificant next to the power of the Force." Culture versus nature. Environmental philosophers differ when it comes to whether human culture is part of the natural world or is significantly distinct because it's a product of deliberate behavior and not the spontaneous processes of nature. This is also left unclear in Star Wars. On the one hand, the Jedi are cosmopolitan. They find the city-planet Coruscant comfortable enough to base their temple where they reside, meet, and educate young Jedi. On the other hand, many cities in Star Wars are full of corruption and decay. Obi-Wan warns Luke as they enter the urban world of Mos Eisley, "You will never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy." The upside of cities is that they allow different people to meet, live, and come together for intergalactic deliberations. The downside is that they offer anonymity, which shelters and disguises dark characters, like shape-shifting bounty hunters and dark lords of the Sith. Consequently, in cities, people try to mind their own business. No one is bothered in the slightest by Han killing Greedo in the Mos Eisley Cantina, and as Qui-Gon says of Mos Espa, spaceports like this one are havens for those who don't wish to be found. Of course, for all the dangers of living in one of the major cities, the dangers of not living in them can be just as great, if not greater. The humanistic values of the Republic manifest in its anti-slavery laws, or simply ignored on Tatooine. The remote world, apart from civilization, can become its own breeding ground for evil. To reconcile the values in the natural world with the humanist values of the Republic, we might look to Obi-Wan's explanation to Boss Nass, the ruler of the Gungans. In order to convince him that he should be concerned for the Naboo during their time of crisis, Obi-Wan reminds him that the Gungans have a symbiotic relationship with the Naboo. "What happens to one affects the other. You must realize this." Later, this natural alliance between the two peoples proves vital for saving both from the Trade Federation. Indeed, the Force's fundamentally symbiotic relations exist not only at the microscopic level of the midichlorians, but among different cultures and forms of beings. As Padme is quite aware, once this point is conceded, an even stronger organic relation is possible, when capable of fighting an entire droid army. For an environmental philosopher like Ralston, natural communities are held together by casual relations, whereas human communities are held together by additional, meaningful relations. Perhaps Obi-Wan's description of the relationship between the Gungans and the Naboo is only a metaphor, since there's a similar split between the natural world and the cultural world of the Democratic Republic. After all, when traveling through the planet Kor on Naboo, Qui-Gon doesn't make such a big deal when his little sea craft nearly gets eaten by a fish, which in turn gets eaten. "There's always a bigger fish," he says calmly. Yet he wouldn't so casually describe the Trade Federation's pressure on the Naboo in this way. Despite his respect for the natural world, he sees that it's governed by very different principles. By contrast, human-like relationships should be governed by democratic principles, which the Jedi regularly defend. Restoring balance to the Force. Ralston reminds us that even in a humanist ethic, there's still a sense that individual welfare is inseparable from the good of the whole, recognizing on a moral level in human affairs the symbiosis in biology. But ultimately, the goal in environmental ethics is to balance the goods of human culture and the goods of the natural world. Achieving balance for humans is actually restoring balance, since it's out of an intricately balanced natural world that we have evolved. Although distinct human communities and natural communities have developed, they're not so different that they can't live in harmony. Restoring balance to the Force, for the Jedi, must mean restoring balance within the entire living community, including cultural and natural worlds. Whether there exists a real or only a metaphorical symbiotic relationship between human communities may be left somewhat unclear in Star Wars. But in either case, restoring the natural symbiotic-like relationship is what the Jedi consistently work toward. It's evident in all they do. Deliberations among the Jedi and between other peoples. Diplomatic missions. And sometimes aggressive negotiations. Negotiations with a lightsaber. The Jedi see themselves as part of a greater whole with other living things. When Anakin begins to see himself as more important than the whole, he begins his break with the Jedi way. Conversely, the redemption of both Han Solo and Lando Calrissian comes about when they each begin to see their role in the larger cause of the rebellion. The Jedi worldview brings us toward an ethic which includes all living things. But unlike environmental ethics, here the interconnections are not just within ecosystems, but to the one living system of the Force. Ultimately, all living things are unified by the living Force, regardless of place. But an important general view of Jedi philosophy is shared with an environmental ethic, namely, that we should extend our ethical worldview to include all living things. The point of environmental ethics is just this idea of inclusion. Such a view reminds conscious beings of their dependence on the natural world and of the interdependence of all living things. Each individual, as precious as he is part of a greater whole. And as it happens, the reward is internal, too. For if we're all part of the living Force, then restoring its balance is also restoring the balance within each of us. Chapter 8. Send in the Clones. The Ethics of Future Wars. Richard Hanley.
Clones can think creatively. You'll find they are immensely superior to droids. They are totally obedient, taking any order without question. We modified their genetic structure to make them less independent than the original host.
Lama Su, Prime Minister of Kamino. It's called Star Wars, and warfare is definitely a very bad thing, with loss of life, injury, and myriad of other kinds of suffering. The toughest kind of ethical question is, when is it okay to do very bad things? When you're the good guys? Maybe that's true, but it's rather unhelpful. When God is on your side? Again, maybe true, but unhelpful. And anyway, isn't the Force with the bad guys as well? In a big way? Two critical questions arise for the moral justification of warfare. When is it okay to engage in warfare, and how should you conduct yourself in warfare? It also matters, of course, how you conduct yourself after warfare. But overlooked in the standard approaches to the ethics of warfare is the question of how to recruit and treat your own combatants. In Attack of the Clones, the Republic faces the prospect of war within its own ranks as a separatist movement led by Count Dooku assembles a massive droid army. Supreme Chancellor Palpatine engineers a vote to counter the threat with an army of clones, which happens to be ready and waiting on Kamino. A battle ensues, and Yoda grimly notes,
"Begun the Clone War has."
This story raises another important contemporary moral issue besides warfare: cloning. Can it be permissible to produce clones of whole organisms? That's what I'll mean by cloning in what follows. What if the organism is a person, like Jango Fett? Can it be permissible to manipulate the process to engineer clones' characteristics, the way the clone army is engineered on Kamino? And in warfare, can it be permissible to use a clone army, rather than typical human beings? In what follows, I'll answer yes to all the above. Cloning gets a bum rap. The defender of warfare takes for granted that something can be inherently bad and permissible. It's also true that something can be wrong and not inherently bad. Public opposition to cloning is visceral, but I'll argue that much of it is misplaced. I don't think cloning is inherently bad. It can be wrong, but we have to answer ethical questions about the wrongness of actions that are not inherently bad by using a cost-benefit analysis. Cloning might be dangerous, like not letting a Wookiee win, or consume valuable resources needed elsewhere, like pod racing, or expensive, like renting the Millennium Falcon, or unreliable, like Han Solo's word, or liable to corruption and abuse, like the Force. It might have little application to human social and medical problems. It might in practice require the wholesale loss of valuable human lives, as those who object to the destruction of human embryos might claim. But if cloning is not inherently bad and harms no one, or does relatively little harm, it's not wrong. Moreover, the burden of proof would be on the opponent of cloning. In the absence of clear evidence that the harms outweigh the benefits, we ought to permit things that are not inherently bad. So why think cloning is not inherently bad? Because there's no good reason to think it is. First, set aside the yuck factor, that the idea of something is disgusting or creepy. Giving Jabba the Hutt a sponge bath, say, has no tendency to show that it is inherently bad. Second, set aside the popular rhetoric. People are apt to use impressive language in condemning cloning, claiming that it's contrary to human dignity, for instance. But what's really needed is cogent argument that it's inherently so. Yet, there doesn't seem anything inherently bad about having a clone or being a clone. Unless you have very strange ideas about identity, having a clone is no threat to your numerical uniqueness. Boba Fett is genetically identical to Jango Fett, but that makes him a cross between a son and a very late identical twin. Sometimes people claim that it's a bad thing to have another individual around that is too much like them. But this is hard to take seriously. We do not regard the lives of genetically identical twins as significantly inferior to those of fraternal twins or non-twins. When Luke discovers he has a long-lost twin, is it a happy occasion if Leia is fraternal and not, as can happen but very rarely, she is differently gendered, identical? Even outside of family, we actively seek out those who have a lot in common with ourselves. Think that the more commonality, the better. Maybe we don't want another person to be exactly like us, but there's no danger of that from cloning, given the enormous contribution of nurture in shaping our characteristics. Looking at it from the other side, from the clone's point of view, if all else is equal, what difference does it make that you're a clone? Sadly, I doubt that all else would ever be equal, but if we treat clones as less deserving of respect than the rest of us, that is our own moral failing and not theirs. Finally, there's a general worry about the employment of artificial or unnatural reproductive procedures. If you still think there's something inherently bad about cloning, compare it with ordinary human reproduction, OHR, and with reproduction by in vitro fertilization, IVF. I submit that if OHR is not inherently bad, then neither is IVF. Remember, I'm not thereby claiming that either is always permissible. If it helps, imagine an IVF case where no embryo is lost or discarded. The point is that we can imagine cases of cloning that parallel a typical IVF case in all the messy details. If the only difference is that we use 100% of one person's genetic material to produce the embryo instead of 50% each of two persons, then surely the cloning is not inherently wrong if the IVF isn't. Curiously, for a good deal of our recent history, it was believed that in OHR, all the essential character of the embryo came exclusively from the man, and that the woman was little more than an incubator. Cloning might be viewed as the equal opportunity realization of this. Assuming I'm right, then cloning has gotten a bum rap, and if cloning is permissibly used to solve social problems, the case for cloning is bolstered, even if it has other costs. So it's good news for cloning if we discover that clone warfare is possible and acceptable. And it's not necessarily bad news for cloning if clone warfare is not a benefit of the process, as long as it's not a significant harm. Getting into your genes. The possibility of a clone army scares a lot of people. Perhaps it's because they think that clones will be more easily manipulated. To control one is to control them all. This danger looms most clearly in the case of genetically determined traits. In a blooper that somehow survived the editing process, an Imperial stormtrooper bumps his head in A New Hope. According to George Lucas, this incident receives a genetic explanation when we see Jango Fett similarly bump his head while entering his ship on Kamino and realize that the trooper is his clone descendant. Jango Fett is not generally a klutz, of course. Otherwise, it would make little sense to clone him for an army. But nature isn't the end of the story. Clones of the same host can still vary greatly in their characteristics. If an army consists of genetic duplicates of the original, an army of Boba, say, then similarities will ultimately depend on nurture, on environmental factors such as diet and education. Raise and socialize them all the same way, and they'll presumably be very similar. But that has little, if anything, to do with cloning. Surely the same thing can be achieved with non-clones, with about the same rate of success. Clones can be bent to an iron will, but so can we. And it doesn't follow that the army will be superior by being raised in a uniform environment. Perhaps it's better to use a variety of environments and see which produces the best soldiers. A survival of the fittest. Indeed, part of the point of the clone army is that it's superior to the droid army because the clones are more flexible, more creative. It's the droids that are supposed to lack autonomy, the capacity to direct their own lives. So there's no need to bend them at all. And they could be all stood down in an instant, as happened when Anakin destroyed the droid control ship in The Phantom Menace. The other clones are not like Boba, however. They are genetically manipulated to reduce their autonomy, to make them a bit more like droids than you and I are. Genetic manipulation scares people too, with or without cloning. But genetic manipulation does not seem inherently bad either. It's playing God, but so what? Genetic manipulation doesn't necessarily harm anyone, as we can see from the following example. Suppose that in the story, Luke Skywalker's parents, other things being equal, would have conceived a genetically deficient child because of an abnormality in the egg. Leia can be safely ignored since she almost certainly came from a different egg. But if it helps, feel free to suppose that there never was a twin. The genetic deficiency is this. The child that would have been born in the absence of treatment would have been missing an arm, a fate that befalls Luke anyway, but from environmental causes. However, the genetic deficiency is corrected prior to conception. There are two ways of describing the outcome. First, we might say that one and the same child, Luke, benefits from the procedure by having two arms rather than one, so the treatment is not inherently bad. I assume that having both arms is a lot better than having just one. But if we intuitively tie identity to genetics, and given that the genetic difference is significant, a better description is that the two-armed Luke is not the same child as the one-armed would have been. You cannot harm a non-existent child, and the existing one, Luke, is certainly not harmed by the treatment. So, the genetic manipulation is not inherently bad. Now, consider the opposite sort of treatment. It clearly harms a normal child to surgically remove its arm, presumably even in the world of Star Wars with its impressive prosthetics. But suppose the treatment had been to alter the genetics of the egg prior to conception, resulting in an armless child, when otherwise a normal child, Luke, would have resulted. Given that genetics is essential to identity, as long as the armless child's life is on balance worth living, it cannot be said that that child has been harmed by the procedure, since without the procedure, it wouldn't have existed at all. This is not to claim that it isn't wrong, but if the procedure is wrong, it's not because some child is a victim of it. Such cases can be puzzling, and it's not clear exactly what form the cost-benefit analysis ought to take, but the fact that they involve genetic manipulation settles nothing. Note the application of this line of reasoning to the production of the clone army. Grant me, for the sake of the argument, that more autonomy is a lot better than less. Then, if the genetic manipulation occurs early enough, it will be reasonable to maintain that no clone is harmed by the process, not the diminished one and not the normal one that would have resulted in the absence of manipulation, as long as the diminished clone's life is on balance worthwhile. I'm inclined to grant that such a life can be worthwhile. First, there are human beings with diminished autonomy who still have happy lives. And second, any worries about the life of a clone soldier being not worth living have more to do with their being soldiers than with their being clones. If it's bad to bring clone soldiers into existence because they will have miserable lives, they arguably are victims whether or not there is genetic manipulation. And if it does not harm the clones, it still may be wrong on other grounds. But the fact that the procedure involves genetic manipulation settles nothing. Different strokes for different folks. There is an alternative to genetic manipulation that has nothing especially to do with cloning. Environmental engineering of the clones as they develop. Hothoused. The FET clones develop at a faster rate biologically and are indoctrinated with intensive military training. Is such environmental manipulation inherently bad? It clearly can have victims, but also have beneficiaries, since in many cases environmental engineering, education for instance, improves the lives of those educated. Two possible features of environmental manipulation are of particular moral concern: deception and coercion. Bending another person's will to your own ends by threats. Some popular ethical theories hold that deception and coercion are inherently bad, and so manipulation involving one or both is inherently bad. According to the philosopher Immanuel Kant, for instance, deception and coercion are wrong because it is always wrong to treat another person merely as a means to your ends. Take brainwashing. This likely involves both deception and coercion, and so is a candidate for inherently bad environmental manipulation. One of the objectionable things about some forms of terrorism is that suicidal terrorists seem to have been brainwashed into unreasonable actions. But even here, we should not jump to the conclusion that manipulating a person's will by coercion or deception is always wrong. When Obi-Wan uses his Jedi powers on the Death Stick dealer in a Coruscant sports bar, that individual changes his desires drastically. He repeats mechanically, "I do not want to sell you death sticks. I want to go home and rethink my life." And leaves. The implication is that Obi-Wan has done him a big favor. So when is it okay to manipulate someone's will? One reasonable answer is when that person already has diminished autonomy. In the attempt to protect children, for instance, we often cultivate attitudes in a manner analogous to brainwashing. We also may deceive them in the process. Perhaps this applies to the death stick dealer. Perhaps not. He is apparently young and has made some bad choices, and so may warrant protection from himself. Another reasonable answer is, environmental manipulation of another's will is okay when it is necessary to protect others from the person to be manipulated. This is the thinking behind ordering someone into therapy as part of their sentence for criminal behavior, and certainly could apply to the death stick dealer. The manipulation of a person's will, genetically or environmentally, is not the only way to get them to do what you want. Another way is to use the desires they already have by making them an offer too bad to refuse. This is a clear case of coercion. When Lando Calrissian betrays Han Solo and his companions, he admits that he does it under threat from Darth Vader. Extraction of information under threat of torture, as Vader does to Han shortly thereafter, is another example. Such coercion seems to be always wrong. Yet, another way to get someone to do what you want is to use the desires they already have by giving them an offer too good to refuse. Call this inducement. It seems we are more comfortable morally with inducement than with brainwashing. Indeed, I think our intuitions tend to go in opposite directions in the two cases. We find inducement more morally problematic the less autonomous the induced individual is. The rather childlike Jar Jar Binks is induced into supporting Chancellor Palpatine's grab for power by his overweening desire to play an important role in the Senate. This leaves us with an interesting question. Given that there is nothing inherently bad about producing the clones in the first place, even with genetic manipulation, might the clones be victims of brainwashing or inducement? And if so, are they any worse off than other combatants in warfare? Are they perhaps better off? Can such treatment be justified in virtue of its role in warfare? To answer, we need to examine the ethics of warfare in general. War. What is it good for? Warfare involves death, injury, and a myriad of other kinds of suffering. The battles spectacularly depicted in Star Wars are entirely typical in this regard. Warfare is inherently bad. But this doesn't mean warfare is always wrong. Sometimes it's permissible to do inherently bad things, such as killing a human being in genuine self-defense. It is sometimes claimed that morality doesn't apply in warfare, a view with the strange name of realism. If true, realism would of course have the consequence that in warfare you can do no wrong, no matter how much harm you do, or to whom. In this respect, realism is hopelessly unrealistic. Equally implausible is absolute pacifism, the view that all violence, and especially killing, is wrong. We are shocked that Obi-Wan allows Vader to kill him. We do seem to allow that a person may lay down their own life for a noble cause, if they so choose. Notice, however, that if absolute pacifism is correct, then you are obligated to let an evil attacker kill you. And moreover, to let them kill anyone else. It's hard to reconcile this judgment with the claim that lives are of equal value. If your life is as valuable as your attacker's, then it's permissible to choose yours over theirs by killing in self-defense. It will come as no surprise, then, that the standard approach to the ethics of warfare is in fact modeled on permissible violence between individuals. In order for violence against another to count as genuine self-defense, it must satisfy the following conditions. Reasonable belief. It must be reasonable for you to believe you are under significant threat, and that must be the reason you use violence. Last resort. If you could simply run away from your attacker and not put anyone else in danger, you ought to run away rather than kill them. And reasonable force. The response must be proportional to the threat, and not significantly threaten others in turn. This also applies to the use of violence to protect others. There are circumstances in which it is permissible to engage in violence to protect your nation or others. The traditional account of these circumstances is called just war theory. There must be just cause, a credible threat, right intention. The reason for fighting is to respond to the threat with the ultimate aim of just peace. Competent authority. The decision to fight is made by true representatives of the nation or group. Last resort. Peaceful means have been exhausted. Reasonable prospect of success. It is credible that a just peace will result. In addition, a nation or group engaged in warfare must satisfy the conditions of discrimination. Only combatants are to be targeted. And proportionality. The force used must be proportionate to the threat faced. These conditions are not easily satisfied, and all must be satisfied for warfare to be permissible. Only the very best of reasons will do. By analogy, consider Anakin's wholesale slaughter of the Sand People. He certainly had something like just cause, since they were responsible for the undeserved suffering and death of his mother. But he acted out of anger and a desire for revenge, and so failed to satisfy the condition of right intention. His response was out of proportion to any threat they presented to him. It certainly wasn't a last resort, and he failed to discriminate by killing the women and children. It is also highly problematic that he acted unilaterally in vigilante fashion. To be all you can be or not, that is the question. Whatever its success, just war theory has had very little to say about the recruitment, training, and deployment of one's own troops. The same is true of international agreements governing warfare, such as the Geneva Convention. Take recruitment. Plato apparently thought that homosexual men make better soldiers, at least in couples, dubiously claiming each will fight more ardently to prove himself a worthy lover. Historically, financial reward has probably delivered more recruits than the promise of glory. Mercenaries like Django Fett